Hello, everyone. Welcome to online church today. Great to be with you if you are at home or if you're in our 6 p.m. service. I'm Jamie, and I'm looking forward to bringing the message to you today. Now, one of the things that's been pretty common over the last number of months has been me bringing you some kind of update because of some kind of change related to the pandemic. And here we are again. I get to bring another update to you. There has been a slight change in the public health order here in BC that we've just become aware of, and so it's resulted in a couple of things that we need to change. One is actually a really good thing, and the other one is not really bad news, but it's something that has required us to make a bit of a change. So firstly, the really good news is that up until now, sort of our 50 cohort gathering has had to include staff and volunteers. So we've been able to welcome about 40 of you to in-person gatherings because, you know, with pastors and media techs and hosts and so on, it's come to around 10. Well, now the public health order has changed, and it doesn't have to include staff and volunteers. So we can offer a full 50, which means we can increase the capacity of each of our in-person gatherings by 10. So that's good. The other piece of information is that they've required us to have 1 hour between the end. If you're doing two services in a row like we are, at least Sunday mornings, 9 and 11, you're required to have an hour between when the last person leaves and when the next person comes for the next gathering. And up until this point, we've had, with our 9 and 11, about 30 to 35 minutes of time to sanitize and clean. So we haven't quite had that amount, and we are required to have the hour. So it's going to mean we have to make a couple of little adjustments. What we're going to do is we're going to move the 9 a.m. service ahead by 15 minutes to 8:45. So apologies to those of you who don't like getting up in the morning, but you're going to need to come 15 minutes earlier. So 8:45. Which will mean we'll be opening the doors around about 8:30. And we figure we can finish the service by about 9:40, giving about 10 minutes then for people to sort of vacate the building by 9:50. And then we're going to keep the 11 the same, but open the doors around 10:50 instead of 10:45. So we're going to have that hour window between 9:50 and 10:50 in which we can fulfill what they're requiring from the health order, which we think is really important for us to do. So the big pieces of information for those of you that do come to in-person gatherings is 8:45 and 11, open the doors at 8:30, open the doors at 10:50. All right. I just want to say thank you so much for hanging in with us and being patient. We know there's been a lot of tweaks and changes that has been characteristic of this time. So thank you. We are working our way through the book of James. So if you have your Bible with you and want to open to chapter 3, we're going to read the first part of that in just a few moments. It was getting late, but she didn't want the evening to end. She'd met him online. His profile revealed a capable guy with numerous impressive accomplishments in his work life. Pictures of him on several beaches, perched on the back of an African safari jeep and hiking in snowy mountains. His profile picture was rugged and attractive, and she'd enjoyed seeing other pictures of him on red carpet-esque ceremonies, everyone in tuxedos and ball gowns. Dinner had been nice. Overlooking the harbor, the sun setting behind the glass towers of downtown, jazz music playing softly in the background. She'd listened to story after story of a life already well-lived, and she yearned for that kind of adventure herself. But he wasn't self-absorbed. He was just as interested in her life, in her hopes, in her dreams, in her stories, and he smiled as she spoke, interrupting only to chuckle at her attempted jokes, but to frown slightly at her self-deprecating comments. She felt her stories were bland in comparison, but he was clearly enjoying them. 6 months later, they were engaged. Since that first dinner, they'd become inseparable. She at times pinched herself, how lucky she was. But unknown to him, she fought her own inner demons, expecting that at some point he'd realize she wasn't worth being with and he'd move on to someone else, likely one of the women in ball gowns. She doubted that this could last, and on some of their dates she would become a little sullen and withdrawn, and he was beginning to wonder whether she was having second thoughts. A few months into their engagement, he began to gently probe and ask her why she had never chased after some of those dreams that she'd spoken about on their first date. She'd shared about how she would love to start a charity for underprivileged kids in her city. And he asked her why she hadn't. Well, she'd never been asked that question before. She stuttered her way to an answer that was unconvincing, but at this point he didn't press her. She knew the real answer, but she just never really had to articulate it before. People like her don't start new things and expect to achieve goals and succeed. In articulating the answer in her mind, she was replaying the words of her harsh parents and teachers and previous boyfriends who had regularly told her she would never amount to anything, that she wasn't smart enough or pretty enough or didn't have the right personality. Those words of discouragement that she'd grown up with had become rooted and established in her mind, playing over and over, becoming a curse, a painful prophecy of failure. Over the next 5 years, her now husband had made it his life goal to replace those curses with words of blessing and encouragement. And in doing so, he was inviting her to be courageous. He was holding that wounded little girl sitting in the floor in the corner of her bedroom and inviting her to stand up and take a step and become a fearless woman no longer bound by the chains of a broken identity. He told her she could do it. Her dreams were not pipe dreams, but achievable goals for a smart, capable, and strong woman like her. And all of a sudden, his words had opened up a whole new world to her. Friends and church family, our words have power. What rolls off our tongue has the power to create and the power to destroy. It shouldn't be lost on us that when God created, he spoke. He spoke and things came into being. Our words can chain someone or they can free someone. Our words can play a part in shaping someone's future, either keeping them trapped in unhealthy cycles or opening up brand new vistas to them. James, the brother of Jesus, has been challenging us as we've read this ancient letter since the early part of September, inspired by God's Spirit. And today, he's going to address the tongue. So we're going to read verses 1 to 12 of chapter 3. Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. For all of us make many mistakes. Anyone who makes no mistakes in speaking is perfect, able to keep the whole body in check with a bridle. If we put bits into the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we guide their whole bodies. Or look at ships, though they are so large and it takes strong winds to drive them, yet they are guided by a very small rudder wherever the will of the pilot directs. So also the tongue is a small member, yet it boasts of great exploits. How great a forest is set ablaze by a small fire, and the tongue is a fire. The tongue is placed among our members as a world of iniquity. It stains the whole body. It sets on fire the cycle of nature and is itself set on fire by hell. For every species of beast and bird, of reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species, but no one can tame the tongue, a restless evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, it ought not to be so. Does a spring pour forth from the same opening both fresh and brackish water? Can a fig tree, my brothers and sisters, yield olives or a grapevine figs? No more can salt water yield fresh. God's word to us this morning. So chapter 3 begins in a way that no preacher really likes very much. What do you mean, James, that teachers are going to be held with greater strictness? That doesn't seem very fair. Well, you know, we're going to need to understand and make sure we understand what's happening here and what the context is and make sure we understand exactly what is going on there. Does it mean that people who teach and preach then have a whole bunch of other things that they're supposed to live up to that other people don't? Does it mean that if teachers and preachers break the law or sin, are they going to be punished more severely than other people? What exactly does this mean? So, for example, if me as a teacher, you know, commit adultery or steal or do something that we know a Christian is not supposed to do, does that mean that I'm going to be punished more than if somebody else does it? And I think if we thought about that, I think we would probably say, well, no, that doesn't seem quite right. I mean, we're all equal before God. We're all called to be followers of Jesus, and we're called to the same kind of Christ-likeness. It may be true that a moral failure of somebody who maybe is sort of a prominent leader in the Christian world would have more of a negative effect on the church and the witness of Christ. I mean, I think we've all cringed when the latest televangelist has been outed for embezzlement or fraud or has slept with his secretary or whatever. I think that's true. But I think we have to be really careful that we don't say that there are different levels of sin, or conversely, there's different levels of Christ-likeness depending on your job or your calling. I don't think we would say that. I think we'd say we're all called to imitate Christ in the same way. What I think that James is getting at here is that teachers have a specific responsibility and therefore are called to sort of this strictness because they're in a position to lead people astray. In the first century, in James's world, you know, there weren't seminaries that pastors and leaders went to for 5 years to get degrees to become pastors. There were no Bible colleges. There were no parachurch teaching organizations. There was no systematic theology text that you could buy and read. There wasn't even a complete New Testament yet. James is part of writing it by God's Spirit. There weren't any major councils yet that had determined what is orthodox theology and what isn't. So that was the context. It was a time of great evangelistic and missionary expansion in response to the truth of the events of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, that the people of the way were saying was fulfillment of ancient Israelite prophecy. So that's the context we have. And it's also true that in Jewish culture, there was all kinds of unofficial teachers that were often invited to come and speak at synagogues. And if you've read the book of Acts, you'll know that Paul was sometimes invited to do that, to speak in the synagogues. And so maybe this was being carried into the early church, this kind of practice. So since there wasn't hundreds of years of faith teaching behind the Christian church because it was so new versus other religions, versus Judaism and so on. And elsewhere in the New Testament letters, we know that false teachers were a real problem for the early church. For the church to develop along the right track and the right belief around Jesus the Messiah and not get off track, James, I think, is sounding a warning to the early church that not anyone should just be able to get up and to teach in the church. Remember, they're all in scattered different places after the persecution that happened in Jerusalem. He then says that everybody makes mistakes. And in fact, if you're somebody who doesn't make a mistake when it comes to the tongue, to teaching, to speaking, then you're near perfect. And he's kind of setting up for what he's going to say later when he talks about no one can really tame the tongue. That's the last thing that gets tamed. So if you're actually perfect in that, if you're able to tame the tongue, then probably everything else is a little easier for you. Maybe you're near perfect. And he uses the image of a horse with a bit in its mouth and a ship with a rudder. Compared to the huge beast, the huge animal that is a horse, a bit in its mouth is pretty small, but it can be used to change the course of the way the entire animal is walking or running. And it's the same with a ship. A ship is huge and a rudder is so tiny, and yet this tiny rudder can be used to change the direction of a huge ship. And so it's the same with our tongue. It's really a very small part of our body. If you were to weigh the tongue, it would weigh hardly anything compared to the rest of your body. It's really very small, but boy, does it have power. So I think part of the point is that the small tongue used in teaching has the power to direct this entire missionary operation that was unfolding in the first century. And if we don't get this right, Not least because we don't have the support of everybody having their own Bibles and systematic theologies and Bible classes and Bible colleges and orthodox statements of belief. We don't have all that stuff. They didn't. If we don't get this right, the whole operation could be threatened. And so I think James is warning them about that. And a lot could be said about verse 5 where it says, so the tongue is a small member and yet it boasts of great exploits. So maybe what was happening is that there were a lot of people getting up to teach in the early church and they were enjoying it and maybe even becoming boastful and liking the position that they had. And James is saying, don't just let any of you become a teacher. We need good leadership, right teaching. And there's lots of external threats to the church and there's plenty of false teachers about. And the greatest strictness piece then is perhaps more along the lines of what Jesus said in Matthew 18, where he says, if any one of you causes one of these little ones to stumble, it'd be better if you had a millstone tied around your neck and you were thrown into the ocean. Don't cause people to stumble in their belief or walk away from their faith because of wrong teaching. That's the strictness piece. Not that teachers have a bunch of extra laws that they have to live up to, or they have a higher moral standard than everybody else. Rather, we're all called to be to live up to the calling of the gospel. And so I think this is definitely a relevant warning to today as it is in the first century. It was a calling to consistency. We need consistent teachers who consistently teach the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. After this, in the second part of the passage we read, it moves from the tongue being used specifically in teaching to the tongue in general. And those of us that live here in British Columbia, we, because of recent years, we are very well acquainted with the reality of forest fires, not least because of this year, maybe not in BC, but on the West Coast, particularly California and Oregon, we've seen forest fires and the deadly effect that they can have. And we know that sometimes forest fires are started because of natural means like lightning and things like that. But the all too often awful truth is that sometimes they can be started by human means. A cigarette butt being thrown out of a window or a campfire that isn't properly put out. And we've seen the devastation that this can have on surrounding communities. And James makes the point that an entire forest blaze can be set by a very small fire, very small action. And again, he's talking about the tongue. And he doesn't mince his word. He calls it a world of iniquity, the tongue. It stains the whole body. It sets on fire the cycle of nature. And we know that to be true, don't we? A misplaced word or a wrongly spoken word can actually destroy a relationship. A bad first impression because of something said can actually end something before it ever begins. A broken promise can destroy a vulnerable person's trust. An unkind thing said can actually erode somebody's identity, how they see themselves. A comment about somebody's looks or body shape can create a lasting insecurity in them. And these kinds of things are real and they happen every day. Words carry an immense power for good or for ill. And James picks that up later when he says that the tongue can be used to bless and it can be used to curse also. And like was demonstrated in that early opening story, unkind, unsupportive words, especially from people who are in sort of authority positions like teachers and parents to people at an impressionable age, can set the course of an entire life. Can set you down a certain path, again, like the rudder of a ship can direct a ship along a certain course. And yet loving, affirming, good, uplifting, healing words can open up brand new worlds to you. James, as part of his argument, then turns from a forest fire to another picture of nature, to creation. And he says, for every species of bird and beast and reptile and sea creature can be tamed and has been tamed by the human species. But no one can tame the tongue. a restless evil full of deadly poison. A great theme of creation in the scriptures at the beginning of Genesis is this idea of, before God said, let there be light, there was this kind of dark, ominous, watery chaos that the Spirit of God kind of hovered over. And from that watery chaos, from that ominous place, God created form and order and life. And so for the ancients, this was an apologetic in many ways of God's power and sovereignty, because a lot of the ancients, they viewed the ocean and the sea as something that was kind of on the edge of their world, and it was something that was threatening and ominous and is often depicted as a monster, like a sea monster in their literature and so on. It was something they feared. And God, overcoming the watery chaos, spoke to his power and his sovereignty. So when Jesus calms the storm, it is far more significant than Jesus just causing the wind to stop blowing, as amazing as that was. But actually, it was a word to Jesus' identity. Just like Yahweh, Jesus had the power to calm the storm, to calm nature, to bring order out of chaos. And it was also prophetic of new creation, of recreation. As he overcame the chaotic forces of nature on Lake Galilee there, so was his death going to be overcome in his resurrection. So for James, following the let there be light is also, of course, let the earth bring forth all kinds of creatures. And we know again from the scriptures that God told Adam and Eve to steward this creation, to have dominion over it. And that's where this idea of taming the wild animals comes from for James, having dominion over the created realm, a dominion given to us by God. But he says, however, no one's been able to tame the tongue. If there's anything that we've failed at, it's taming the tongue. It is a restless evil. It's full of deadly poison. And where it is really stark is where James says, with it we bless the Lord and Father, and with it we curse those who are made in the likeness of God. In James's world, kings and emperors would often have statues made of themselves that we put in their towns and villages and cities of their realm to prove and to remind the people who they were. And sometimes it was the case that if you were caught cursing or insulting the statue, it was seen as almost as though you were cursing and insulting the emperor to his face, because the statue is the image of the emperor. Well, it's the same here. Insulting a child of God who is made in the image of God is like insulting God himself. So for Christians today, we also can be incredibly inconsistent with our use of the tongue. We can come to a worship service and sing all kinds of amazing words of praise and worship to God and leave the church building and say some terrible things to or about people who are made in God's image. And so again, we have a calling to consistency. If ever there is an area of life where we need to be consistent, says James, it will be in the use of our tongues. We can't bless one moment and curse the next. It cannot be an instrument of heaven one moment and an instrument of hell in another. No spring can give out salt and fresh water, so you can't have blessing and cursing coming from the same mouth. There are many examples in the Christian world of times where we are inconsistent and hypocritical. In the Catholic tradition, it is very easy to misuse the notion of confession. You can live a life that looks nothing like Jesus because you know you can go to confession and get wiped clean. And although in the Protestant tradition, we don't usually confess to a priest and a pastor in the same way as our Catholic friends do, nevertheless, we do the same thing. We can live a life that is very contrary to what Jesus calls us to live. And we can have no intention of actually changing that, knowing that God forgives us anyway. We're familiar with the idea of presenting our Sunday best at church, but living nothing like that at home. Well, what about the consistency of the tongue then? I was once at a conference and the speaker was Dallas Willard. And Dallas Willard is the late professor and writer on the spiritual life. And he was being interviewed on stage, and the interviewer was asking him about a time when he was teaching at the seminary he taught at. And one of the students got up and they sort of ripped into him about what he was teaching and contradicted everything. And it was towards the end of the session, and Dallas just quietly ended the session and sent people on their way. And one of the other students came up to him and said, "Dallas, why didn't you respond? Like, you should have responded to this guy, because you could have, like, you're way smarter than him. You could have torn down his argument and so on." And Dallas's simple response was, "Yes, I could have, except this week I've been working on the spiritual discipline of not having the last word." And how many of us could learn from having a discipline like that, hey? A discipline of not needing to have the last word. Choosing to bite the tongue in given situations for the benefit of ourselves, actually, but especially to those we might lash out at. The psalmist in Psalm 141 says, "O Lord, set a guard over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips." For those of us who maybe the Holy Spirit is convicted, as we've been talking about this in James, as we've been reading and reflecting on it, maybe there are things that we have said to people that have caused pain. Maybe not an abundance of pain, or maybe a lot of pain, like in our original story that has caused someone's life to be altered significantly. Whatever it is, would the Spirit be prompting you to make amends, to confess, but also to seek the person's forgiveness? Friends, by way of another application, what if we became a people who went beyond the calling just to make sure we're not being negative with our tongue, as great as an application as that is, but what if we wanted to become a people of blessing, a people who went out of our way to bless other people? What worlds might we open up for others? What might be achieved by people who are encouraged to pursue their dreams, perhaps things that God had spoken to them at some point in their lives? In the whole area of soul care, caring for our souls, sometimes there are curses that people live with that are more than just negative things said. Sometimes there's spiritual curses that need to be broken. And sometimes the first step of breaking that ground is helping them to understand their blessed identity in Jesus. Some people live several generations down a family line that has lived behind or with a certain belief about their heritage and their family, and it's just the way it is, and it's become almost like a family curse or a generational curse. And the ground can be broken by words of blessing and hope, and it's usually the beginning of somebody gaining freedom as we break the stranglehold of the negative words spoken over them, or spoken to them. I mentioned earlier that words have creative power. Well, God spoke and things came into being. Now, we can't create anywhere near like God can, but we have God's Spirit living in us, and we can certainly be used to create within people things, or within somebody, things that bring hope or encouragement or strength. So, church family and friends, as you reflect further on this whole area of the tongue, may God's Spirit guide and direct you. Maybe there are some things you need to put right. Maybe there are some things you need to stop doing. Maybe there are some things you need to start doing. So God bless you, and amen.